Well, good evening, everyone, and welcome to the presidential lecture for spring of 2008. This lecture series was established 5 years ago as a way to showcase the university's outstanding faculty members and their research directions to the broader university and Ames community. Tonight's lecture is the 10th in the series. We've had 9 outstanding lectures in the past, and having heard Pat speak before, I know that that we'll have a 10th one after tonight. Our speaker tonight is Dr. Pat Schnabel, who was just a few moments ago formally installed as the Baker Professor in Agronomy. And Professor Schnabel will be formally introduced by our Executive Vice President and Provost, Dr. Elizabeth Hoffman.
Thank you, President Joffre. This is a great honor for me to introduce Dr. Pat Schnabel. Dr. Schnabel received his bachelor's degree from Cornell University and his PhD from Iowa State, where he studied with Peter Peterson, who I believe is with us this evening, and he certainly was with us earlier for the installation ceremony, so we're very, very pleased to have him with us. He then went on to do postdoctoral research in Germany and returned in 1988 to Iowa State University. He's currently a professor in the departments of agronomy and genetics development and cell biology. He manages a vigorous research program that emphasizes interdisciplinary approaches to understanding plant biology. He also serves as PI or co-PI on several multi-million dollar research grants, publishes and lectures widely, and is active in technology transfer, having deposited hundreds of thousands of DNA sequences in GenBank. He serves as director of the Center for Plant Genomics within the Plant Sciences Institute. And to stay at the cutting edge of research, he has consistently adopted the most advanced techniques to address biological questions. He was instrumental in the establishment of the Iowa Computational Biology Laboratory. And most recently, in collaboration with Drs. Oluru in computer science, whom I saw a few minutes ago, and Ashrock in mathematics at the University of Guelph, his team assembled and released an assembly of the maize genome that many of you may have read about in the newspaper recently. This was a major, major contribution to genomics. He's an active participant in our interdisciplinary graduate training program and helped to establish a graduate training program in bioinformatics that is modeled after the maize genetics training program. It's also funded by industry. He's received several NSF grants to bring undergraduate students to Iowa State University, including most recently one associated with the National Science Foundation that supports undergraduate students at Truman State University. And when I asked him, what would you like me to talk about in my introduction, he said, please mention my undergraduate students and how important they are in my laboratory and my graduate students and how important they are in my laboratory. So I see a number of both his undergraduate and graduate students are here with us this evening. As you heard from Dr. Joffre, he was just made the Baker Professor, together with his co-author, Dan Nettleton, who was also named a Baker Professor at the same time. And it's a very fitting honor and to hear from him this evening. So please join me in welcoming Pat Schnabel.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be here to talk about one of the true passions in my life. And you should always worry when someone says they're going to tell you about a passion in their life. So we're going to talk about crop genomes, and we're really going to focus on maize because that's what I work on. But much of what I say is generally applicable. We'll start by going through a brief overview of the maize genome sequencing project, and then talk about how we can use this information to start connecting genes to traits so we can start identifying which genes are important for example, agronomically significant traits like lodging and yield and drought tolerance. Then we'll look at how data from the Maize Genome Sequencing Project can help us address basic biological questions, which in addition have important economic significance. So we'll look at the molecular basis of heterosis or hybrid vigor. We'll talk about the genetics of crop domestication. We'll look at the genetic improvement of biomass crops, a very hot topic these days. And then we'll introduce a new type of crop, carbon capturing crops. So let's begin with the Maize Genome Sequencing Project. The maize genome is as large as the human genome. It has more genes than humans. That's not something we all understand intuitively at first, but plants need more genes to control their behavior because they don't have a nervous system. So if we get hot or thirsty, we have a nervous system which allows us to decide to go into the shade and get a drink. A plant needs to have responses to environmental stresses all built into it. The genome is also much more complex than that of humans, which makes the genome sequencing and assembly a much bigger challenge. But even so, a draft genome was released last month. This is a dream come true for maize geneticists, and I'm going to tell you how that genome sequence can be used to understand biology and make advances in crop improvement. So, you know, what is a genome project? It's really the discovery of all of the genetic material, deciphering the genetic material of a species. And I liken this to the Lewis and Clark expedition. So just as we embarked, in St. Louis, on sequencing the maize genome, the Lewis and Clark expedition explored this newly purchased unknown area. And like the Lewis and Clark expedition, we had to do some extensive planning and coordination. And like the Lewis and Clark expedition, there were some setbacks, but we overcame them. Both the Lewis and Clark expedition and a genome project are expensive. They're exploration of the unknown, which means, we generate a lot of information and a lot of different kinds of information. So they brought back skins, animal skins, and dried plants and maps. And we have a lot of different kinds of information from the genome, too. And this requires us to put it all together to gain understanding from the information that we've gathered. And we expect a lot of surprises. This is the exciting thing about genome projects. It's not the sort of project where we do something and we pretty much know the result at the other end. There are going to be complete surprises, and I'll perhaps share some of those today. Technically, to sequence a genome, we don't have the ability. DNA in genomes is organized into chromosomes, long strands of DNA. The maize genome has 10 such strands. We can't sequence from one end to the other. Technically, our ability to sequence requires that we chop DNA up into small pieces to sequence it. So that's what this is illustrating, is chopping the DNA up into small pieces. And then we have to put it back together again, much as we assemble a jigsaw puzzle, except instead of a few hundred pieces, we're looking at hundreds of thousands and millions of pieces that need to be put together again. And these pieces aren't all that different from each other sometimes, which makes it very hard to make sure how to put that puzzle together. And to assist with this, Iowa State purchased, with the leadership of Cernavis Alaru, my collaborator, a supercomputer, an IBM BlueGene supercomputer, which has 2,000 processors. And at the time we bought it, 2 years ago, it was one of the top 100 fastest computers on the planet now. Cernavis tells me it doesn't even come close to anywhere on the list now, 2 years later. So it's time to buy a new one. So he's gone out. He's gone out to NSF and raised another million or so and is in the process of buying another one. So I'm not going to talk about the technical details of how the genome is assembled. What I want to do is talk about how we can use this information to advance both basic biology and crop improvement. So you might ask, you know, why bother with this? If you know something about corn breeding, these are yield of corn over time, and the numbers are small here, but this is 1935 here, which is an inflection point. That was when hybrid corn was introduced into the U.S. and began to make substantial market penetration. This is double cross hybrids. For those of you that know something about corn breeding, these are single cross hybrids, and this is the biotech era. There has been steady improvement since 1935. The plant breeders have done an outstanding job. Good, steady improvement year by year. Now, it costs more every year. So that same gain each year is becoming more and more expensive. It's becoming harder and harder to make these improvements. And so this is where technological innovation helps. It reduces the cost of genetic gain. And in addition, we face enormous challenges. Agriculture faces enormous challenges now that need to be met. We need to continue to increase crop yields, make crops more resistant to environmental stresses and pests. This is because agriculture is being called upon not only to produce more and more food as the world population grows, but more feed, which means animal food, as human diets add more meat in many countries, fiber, and now more and more agriculture is being asked to produce fuel. And this has very significant implications that we'll discuss as we move through this talk. And we have to do this on decreasing amounts of arable land. As cities expand, highways expand, as desertification takes place, agricultural inputs cost more and more. Some of them have reduced availability, like water, which there will be wars fought over water supplies. There are undesirable ecological impacts from the use of large amounts of some agricultural inputs, and there are technological solutions to minimize these ecological footprints, but they will require additional R&D. And in addition, it's quite clear that the climate is changing. It is becoming more variable, and there are going to be consequences for agriculture. Agriculture depends on steady, predictable weather patterns. And so as we have additional droughts and floods, temperature extremes, new pests and diseases which come in with changing climate, our agriculture is going to suffer unless we have genetic mechanisms built into our plants to withstand these stresses. So this is what we can use information from the Genome Project. We can begin to identify which genes control traits, such as drought tolerance, such as nutritional content, such as standability, so that we can build into our crop plants the ability to withstand stresses and to produce higher yields that our planet is demanding. So I used to say that a genome sequence was analogous to an instruction manual. This is a telephone. So it turns out not a great analogy. An instruction manual, if you read it carefully, tells you how to operate the telephone. But as we look at the genome sequence, a better analogy is a wiring diagram full of indecipherable symbols connected in odd and bizarre ways, and we've got to somehow figure out what this means. We have a lot of DNA sequence. Where are the genes? How do they fit together? How do they interact? How do they work together to grow a corn plant? And we don't know what any of that means. So how do we do this? Well, one approach is what are called association studies. So when we look at the corn genome, and this is true for any genomes, including the human genome, approximately one-third to one-half of the genes that we can recognize, and we can't recognize all of them, but of the genes we can recognize, a third to a half have not even a predicted function. We have no clue what this gene is doing. It must have a function, or a random mutation would have disabled it. It has a function. We have no clue what it is. And even for the others, where we have predicted functions, those predicted functions are often wrong, and we don't understand how the various genes interact with each other to allow the plant to grow and develop. So this technology or approach of genome-wide association has a great deal of attractiveness because it has the power to link genes to traits or functions. And I'm going to go through how this works because it's, I think, going to transform plant biology. So I call these guilt by association studies. And this is a movie I saw a long, long time ago. It's an Alfred Hitchcock movie. And the young Teresa Wright character suspects her uncle of being a murderer, in fact, of being the Merry Widow murderer. And she's worried that this guy is not as nice as he seems. And she starts looking at the postcards or the envelopes she gets from him. He travels extensively. And she starts noting the date and the location from which he sends these letters. And she starts plotting them on a map along with newspaper clippings of where the murders are taking place. And she finds a very strong association. So she's developed the hypothesis that, I'm not sure if this is not the uncle, but anyway, the uncle is a murderer. And so she has this hypothesis, and she tests the hypothesis by confronting him, and in fact, she's right. So these are this is the basis of an association study. It's guilt by association. It's looking for coincidence of particular genes and traits. And all it gives us is a hypothesis that that gene is associated with a trait. It's necessary to go further and test that hypothesis, but we have ways for doing that. So we can go from the 50,000 genes that are in maize down to one or a few that are likely to be important for a particular trait. So this is the way it works, and I'm not going to go through this in a lot of detail, but if we have tall plants and short plants, and they exhibit DNA differences, the tall plants and the short plants, if we cross them together, we have red DNA and blue DNA, and of course it doesn't look this way, but we have ways of telling the red and the blue apart. And if we make crosses between these parents, we get progeny, and biology shuffles DNA from generation to generation. This is why you don't look like your siblings. One reason you don't look like your siblings. And we get shuffling of DNA, and we can correlate the phenotypes of these progeny, whether they're short or tall, and we can ask which bits of DNA are always present in the tall plants and which ones are always present in the short plants. And we can find which genes, if we know the sequence of the genome, which genes are always associated with tallness and which ones are associated with shortness. So this is an association study. And it's very, very powerful. It's being used a lot in human biology to, for example, find genes that are associated with predisposition to certain diseases, with the idea that if you can tell people that they have risk of, for example, heart disease, they can take special precautions with diet, exercise, and perhaps drugs. So maize is a very genetically diverse species, and this is a critical aspect for association studies, is that there be genetic diversity, because if there's no difference among the individuals, we can't do association studies. Turns out humans are, we all look very different, but genetically we're all basically the same. Corn is quite different. It is extremely diverse. Phenotypically it's very diverse, but if we look at the DNA, it's very diverse. To give you a sense of how diverse it is, these two organisms here, this guy and that primate there, actually have the same amount of genetic diversity that we find in maize is found between humans and their closest primate relatives. So maize is an extraordinarily diverse species, and we can exploit that diversity both to find the genes, to identify which genes are important for traits, but we can also exploit that genetic diversity to improve this crop. So maize is really an ideal model for association studies. The structure of its genome is ideal, including the genetic diversity. It's an agronomic crop, which means we can plant large amounts of corn in replicated trials all across, say, the state of Iowa, and we can get unmanned planes, low-flying planes, to fly over the fields and collect infrared data and reflectance data from these plants. And we can use GPS to locate which plants are reflecting in which way, and we know the genotypes of those plants. We can envision doing extraordinarily large-scale phenotypic, we now call it phenomics, projects that will allow us to identify which genes in these corn plants are controlling which traits. This can't be done with humans. There is, however, there are engineering challenges here, building non-destructive, high-throughput technologies, remote sensing that will allow us to collect these data. So there are some challenges here. But Iowa State's a great place. You know, we've had really, really wonderful collaborations between biologists and computational scientists in both LAS and the College of Engineering. Now we need to build those sorts of connections between the biologists and the engineers that build things, that measure traits. We'll generate a lot of data, disparate data types. But again, and these need to be analyzed, but again, Iowa State's a wonderful place for computational analyses. We have great strengths here in computer science and statistics and mathematics. So I think this is going to be a very fruitful direction. And great mapping populations have been built in maize. Because maize is so easily crossed, we can build large, diverse populations that are ideally suited for this association mapping. So there's already an early success from this kind of association mapping, these guilt by association studies. And that has to do with vitamin A, the biosynthesis of vitamin A. So in the developing world, where people's diets are rather often quite restricted, vitamin A deficiency appears, particularly among kids, and it causes a lot of problems, including blindness. But it wasn't clear how to increase the amounts of vitamin A in crops. And so association mapping was used to identify a particular gene in the maize genome that accounts for substantial amounts of vitamin A, variation in vitamin A content. So this gene has been identified using these guilt by association studies approaches and is being incorporated into marker-assisted breeding programs in the developing world. So This is a review from the New York Times, and this technology really is one that's going to allow maize geneticists to go wild. I expect within the next 3 to 5 years, we're going to see large-scale analyses coming out where scientists have identified genes that are associated, critical, for various important traits. For example, standability, drought tolerance, disease resistance, nutritional quality. So now I want to turn to how we can use genome information to address basic questions in biology. But I'm going to use examples of basic questions that also have economic importance, societal importance. So one of these is heterosis or hybrid vigor. This is a biological phenomenon discovered about exactly 100 years ago, published by George Shull, doing very basic studies at Cold Spring Harbor Lab, not interested in corn, not interested in yield or agriculture. He was trying to understand the basics of inheritance. But he stumbled upon an interesting observation, and it was this one, that if he takes particular inbred lines, particular lines or genotypes of maize, this doesn't work for all lines, but if you take particular combinations of lines and you cross them together, you get an F1 or a hybrid that substantially outperforms the parents. This is hybrid vigor, and it is upon this biological phenomena that the great seed companies of the world, Pioneer, Monsanto, Syngenta, have built their industry. It has accounted for substantial yield gains around the world and continues to be absolutely critical to agriculture. And we don't understand it. Not at all. We really don't understand why particular lines, when crossed together, do this. And indeed, we can't even, with any reasonable probability, pick out which lines to cross to which other lines. There are a few general clues that we can use. But basically, it's trial and error. That's how we deal with black boxes, trial and error. Now, it affects yield, grain yield, but it also affects biomass. So this understanding this trait is also important for the biofuel industry, not just for grain yields. So the literature is full of ideas. You know, we can't do an experiment or we can't collect data. We can always think about it and come up with hypotheses. The literature is full of various ideas, and I think very good ideas on how heterosis works. But it wasn't until we had access to the whole genome that we could start to really look at these, test these hypotheses on a genome-wide scale. So my prediction is, and I'm not going to go through the answer because we don't have the answer, but my prediction is that as we look at the genome as a whole, we will begin to understand the mechanisms responsible for heterosis, and we'll find that there are multiple mechanisms, and we'll probably also identify new mechanisms that, just as George Shull discovered heterosis by trying to do basic studies on quantitative genetics, I fully expect that our analysis of heterosis, and I emphasize it's not just us, heterosis is critical for crops around the world, and so there are hundreds of people working on this problem, that working together we are going to find new biological phenomena which will start a new round of scientific investigation. Our goal is not to get this sorted out in the next couple of years, but in the next couple of years, I would like us to be able to make reasonable predictions about which hybrids, which inbreds should be crossed together. So let's say we have 8 inbreds. We're a small seed company. We only have 8 inbreds. And we combine our A, B, C, and D, and we want to combine them with E, F, G, and H. And we make all possible combinations here, and we put these out in replicated yield trials. And that's 16 hybrids to test. That's not so bad. But if we've got 100 inbreds, well, 100 of these and 100 of those, that's 10,000 of these things to test. And these are in replicated yield trials. We've got them scattered all over the Midwest and maybe even beyond. This is a lot of work. So if our investigations can help us tell the seed companies which half of the inbreds are dogs and need not even be tested, we've made a substantial benefit here. So instead of testing 16, we only have to test 4. Or instead of testing 10,000 combinations in a more realistic experiment, we only have to test 2,500. They won't leave those plots blank. What they'll do is they'll test these more extensively and make genetic gain faster and better for the benefit of the shareholders and society. Okay, let's talk about crop domestication. This is the process by which our ancestors took wild species and converted them into crops. That's domestication. Absolutely critical to our civilization. If our ancestors hadn't domesticated wheat, corn, rice, rye, barley, we wouldn't be here. Our civilization literally depends on those several grain crops that were domesticated 10 or more thousand years ago. So we're very interested in what was it that these early agriculturalists did to the crop genomes to convert a wild species into a crop species. Well, we can look at crops and compare them to wild relatives, and we can see some phenotypic changes that occurred. And these are informative. So typically, the architecture of the plant has changed. There's less branching. The plants are more upright. They have larger fruit or grain. That seems like a pretty good thing. Changes in photoperiod sensitive. Wild plants have evolved mechanisms to sense the environment and decide when to flower. When we're growing crops, we want to tell the plant when to flower. So we want to get rid of that trait. We want to override the default parameters. Synchronized seed maturation. Wild plants like to mature their seeds at different times so the birds don't all come and eat them all at the same time. We don't want that to happen. We want to be able to harvest, and everything should be ripe at the same time. We don't want seed dispersal. Wild plants need to get their seeds dispersed to get the next generation scattered across the environment. We do not want our crops to scatter the seeds on the ground where we have to crawl around and pick them up. Loss of seed dormancy. We want to be able to plant the seed and have it come up when we want it to come up. We're overriding default parameters. And also changing the composition of crops. Our ancestors removed toxic compounds from crops to make them more palatable and nutritious. So there's a precedent for changing the composition of crops. That's going to be important in a few slides. So how do we identify the genes? How do we identify the genetic changes that early agriculturalists placed onto the genomes of these wild species to convert them into crops? Well, fortunately, genes that have been part of the domestication process have a distinctive molecular signature, which we can identify by extensive sequencing. So it's possible to go into the genome of rice, for example, and identify a gene that reduces shattering, a gene that was selected for, a gene that was part of the domestication process, and just as we would expect, it reduces shattering. So this is a phenotype that's a trait that's important for a crop. We don't want the seed to scatter across the field, and it has the signature of domestication. Maize is a great model for studying domestication. The reason is, there are several reasons, but one of the reasons is that it was domesticated only 10,000 years ago in Central America from a wild species called Teosinte. This is one Teosinte plant, and that's about 20 feet tall here in Iowa. Teosinte is still alive, so we can actually conduct comparative analyses at both the phenotypic level and at the DNA level between this domesticated corn crop and its wild relative to help us understand the domestication process. We can also make crosses between maize and Teosinte and get fertile offspring, which allows us to study the genetics of domestication. This, by the way, is the seed of Teosinte as compared to various maize seeds. So maize is a great model for studying domestication. So I want to give you a couple examples of what we've learned as a community. One has to do with a gene called Teosinte branched 1, which controls the genetic architecture of plants. So this is Teosinte. This is a maize plant. And if you mutate the Teosinte 1 branched gene, you get a plant that looks a lot like Teosinte again. This is a critical gene in the domestication of maize. This is work of John Dobley at the University of Wisconsin, and he's been studying this essentially his entire professional career. And he's now developed a whole pathway of genes that interact with Teosinte branched and that are involved in the domestication by changing the architecture of the corn plant. Here at Iowa State, one of our faculty members in the Department of Genetics, Development, and Cell Biology, Eric Volbrecht, cloned a gene that is involved in the architecture of the ear. So this is the maize ear, which is a very unusual structure in the plant world. And if you make a mutation in the Ramosa 1 gene, you get an ear that's highly branched. You also affect the architecture of the tassel. So what Eric has found here is a gene that was involved in the evolution of the maize ear, which is, as I say, an extraordinary botanical structure. So why study the domestication process? Well, the reason, besides being interesting per se, is that we are going to need to domesticate additional crops. So we speak about dedicated bioenergy crops. You hear this all the time, about switchgrass and miscanthus. But these, in fact, are not crops. They are wild species. They have not been domesticated. They're seed shatters. They have the attributes of a wild plant. If we're going to use these species, if we're going to convert them into crops, we need to understand the domestication process. We don't want to go through the process that our ancestors went through 10,000 years ago. Why not? Looking at wheat, we can look in the archaeological record. We can identify wheat heads that are non-shattering and those that shatter. And we can look at the archaeological record and we can ask the question, how long did it take to domesticate wheat and barley? And the answer is somewhere between 200 and 1,000 years. We don't have time to wait that long to develop dedicated bioenergy crops. So we can take the lessons of history, we can look at the domestication of maize and rice and other crops, and use that information to speed the domestication of dedicated bioenergy crops. Which segues into the next topic. So the genetic improvement of biofuel crops. All right, if you, everybody here lives in Iowa, this is the New York Times view of what's going on right now. I mean, row-to-row cropping of corn because of the boom of bioenergy. This is truly an extraordinary event of the last few years, the change in cropping systems that we've seen. And it's been great to talk to farmers, the increased income levels, the excitement. There's a lot of positive here. But it's not all positive. There are problems coming up. So there's this whole food versus fuel issue, and it's, believe me, this is a serious, serious issue. We all, I think, everybody in this room, has had plenty to eat all week. There are people in the world that are really suffering, and they're going to suffer more. It's going to be the poorest of the poor that are going to get the backlash from this food versus fuel issue. So biofuel production has already raised the cost of animal food, which raises the cost of meat, but it's also raising the cost of food per se. And we live in a global world. The cost of corn here and everywhere else equilibrates. So when we pay more for corn, so are the people who are living on corn, and that's all they get to eat. They're paying more for it. So this is a big issue. And we can't just increase yields of corn grain. That isn't going to work. And the reason it's not going to work, Dermot Hayes, my colleague in ag economics, gave us a really wonderful lecture about a month ago that really opened my eyes here. Because corn can be converted into ethanol, which is substitutable for petroleum, there's essentially an unlimited demand for ethanol and hence for corn. So it doesn't matter how much corn you produce, the price doesn't change. All that drives the price of corn now is the price of petroleum. So it doesn't matter whether we produce more and more and more and more corn. We're not going to solve this problem by producing more and more corn. So what about using lignocellulosic crops? We've heard about that. By the way, for people that don't know corn, that's my wife and son there, just to give you a scale of how much corn we can produce. So what about using lignocellulosic biofuels? This is the idea of taking the stalks, the leaves of plants, either stover from corn or dedicated bioenergy grasses, and converting that into liquid biofuels. The problem is, biomass, which is the stalks, the leaves, and so forth, is a very complex mixture of compounds, and it's hard to break down. So when we take starch and make it into ethanol, so we take corn grain and make ethanol out of it, as we're doing now, this is pretty easy. We and our ancestors have been doing this for thousands of years. We know how to do that. But this is hard. This is really hard. The enzymes and the bacteria and the microorganisms, the yeast that we use, can't easily break down lignocellulosic material, this biomass. It's expensive and it's hard. But there is an opportunity to use the information that we've learned from the genome sequencing projects to re-engineer corn plants and biofuel plants, dedicated bioenergy plants. We can re-engineer these plants to change the chemical structure of the biomass so that it is more easily broken down into simple sugars that can be fermented into biofuels. That's certainly something that can be done, and there's a lot of interest and there's a lot of activity in this throughout the whole world, actually. You don't need to get all of these structures memorized, but it would be good to get at least this end of the pathway down for the exam. So we know a lot, and there's a lot we don't know, but it's possible to understand the biosynthesis of this lignocellulosic material, the cell wall materials, and then go in using rational approaches and change these pathways so that we end up with biomass that is more easily converted into liquid fuels. So Why? Well, one is to deal with this issue of food versus fuel. Another is to make it economical to generate liquid fuels from biomass. And biofuels, one of the advantages, one of the things that's so exciting about them, is they have the potential to improve the environment because we're recycling carbon, right? Rather than burning petroleum products and taking carbon from deep underground and putting it into the atmosphere, we're taking carbon from the currently growing crop. We harvest it, we convert it into fuel and burn it, release that CO2 in the air, and we have a cycle. That's pretty good. It always rains on a picnic, doesn't it? Okay, two very, very important papers came out in Science quite recently, February 29th. One of them with an Iowa State author, Dermot Hayes, the individual I mentioned from the Ag Econ Department, co-author. Another one with authors from Minnesota. What these guys found is a very, very important finding, is that when you, and of course this has now captured the interest of the public as a whole, what has been recognized here is that when we grow additional, when we convert land here to biofuel production that used to be producing feed or fuel, food or feed. So if we take a corn acre that used to go right into the pigs or the cows, and we instead take that corn and convert it into ethanol, what happens? Well, it is a global market for corn. And there are people that are hungry. Some of them won't be able to afford the new price, but a lot of them can. So new land comes into production somewhere on the planet because there's people want to eat. What happens? Well, this picture is purportedly the Amazon, and that's a little bit of rainforest, and that's all cropland that's been leveled and converted to farmland. The problem here is that when you take rainforest, or indeed forest, or indeed grassland, and convert it to agricultural land, you release an awful lot of CO2. An awful lot. In fact, when you do this, it takes 30 to 100 years of biofuel production to pay off the carbon debt that you incur when you convert wild lands to agricultural lands. This is a really big problem. And it's one of those unexpected consequences that it's awfully nice we found it now rather than 10 years from now. So how do we deal with this? Let me continue to illustrate the problem a little bit before we solve it or discuss how we might solve it. This is a plot of soil organic matter. So, you know, the soil is, it's not just dirt. It's a complex ecological ecosystem, actually. And plants die, and their bodies, their biomass, is slowly degraded, and CO2 is returned to the atmosphere. But during the process of degrading, that lignocellulosic material is converted into organic matter, which functions like a sponge in the soil. It holds water and releases it slowly. It holds nutrients and releases it slowly. It buffers the soil. It's very, very important for soil productivity and for ecological good. So if we add fertilizers to soil and there's good organic matter, those fertilizers don't immediately run off into streams and end up in the Mississippi River and then the Gulf of Mexico. What we see, though, this is 1900. These are Midwest soils. As soon as you start plowing those soils, you have a substantial reduction in soil organic matter. This is because you're introducing oxygen, which stimulates microbial growth, which breaks down the organic matter, releasing CO2. So the first thing that happens when you go into the rainforest or any undisturbed land and convert it to agriculture is you disrupt the soil, introduce oxygen, soil organic matter goes down, CO2 is released. That's where that 30 to 100 years of carbon debt comes every time we make one of those conversions. This is a big problem. Starting around 1960, 1970, things got a little better. They're not a lot better, but they got a little better. This is due to no-till, reduced tillage. So we can modify our agricultural practices to improve soil organic matter. But we're nowhere near to getting back to where we were in an undisturbed ecosystem. So let's talk about maize stover. And maize stover has a very special attribute for biofuels, and that is that it doesn't necessarily contribute to the carbon debt. Okay, so why is this a good source? Obviously, we grow corn already. It has high yields. We have a lot of tools. But here's the important thing for today. Unlike dedicated bioenergy crops, let's say we go into the tropical rainforest, we cut it down, we plow the land, we plant switchgrass. Okay. unlike this. Stover comes from ground which is already converted to agriculture. We've already taken the carbon hit for converting, frankly, the bulk of Iowa to agricultural land. We've already paid the cost. We can grow corn, harvest the grain, and the stover, the leaves, the stalks, the cobs, is essentially a freebie. It doesn't add to the carbon debt. So this is a very good argument for using corn stover as a source of lignocellulosic ethanol. But again, nothing's free. Here's the problem. Corn stover, a large part of the corn stover, is traditionally returned to the soil where it contributes to soil organic matter. There is a cycle. If we start taking all of the stover off of cornfields, what happens? We take it off, it gets converted to bioethanol or biofuels. What happens? The soil organic matter starts going down. We don't know yet how much we can take off for biofuels and not interfere with these currently still modest levels of soil organic matter. And it's going to vary. It's going to vary based on soil type and the slope of the soil and agronomic practices. But it's clear we can't take it all. We can't. So what do we do? This is where this new center for carbon capturing crops comes in. And here I'm going to speak about some possibilities on how we can meet some of these challenges. You've seen this slide before and you've memorized it already, so I don't have to leave it up here. But I spent in the fall of 2006, I was flying back and forth between here and San Diego and here and Maryland literally every week, thinking about ways we could re-engineer plants to be better biofuel crops. And we could more easily break the lignocellulosic down and convert it into liquid fuels. Every week, I was on the airplane. And my wife pointed out to me that I was burning an awful lot of petroleum, an awful lot. And this, I had a brainstorm sitting on the plane, and we sort of look at the other side of the coin here. So here we're looking, how do we make that cell wall material more easily breakdownable? So we can more easily break down that cell wall material and convert it into simple sugars and ferment it. And I had this realization that we could go the other way around. What if we re-engineer that cell wall material to make it harder to break down? Let's look at what happens. Okay, this is the CO2 cycle. So there's CO2 in the air, and plants, using photosynthesis, capture that CO2 and incorporate it into sugars which are used to build the cell walls and the plant body. Eventually, those plants die, or they are harvested, and they are either eaten by animals or by us, or they're returned to the soil, but through some process, they decay or are digested, and the CO2 that was captured is released back into the atmosphere. This is the carbon cycle. And like most nice cycles, it runs, and it runs. And then we come along and we start burning fossil fuels. We have coal-fired electric plants. We have gasoline in our cars. And CO2 that was captured a long time ago and sequestered deep in the ground is being released into the atmosphere. So CO2 levels rise, and it's quite clear that these rising levels of CO2 are associated with global climate change. Really a scary thing. So what can we do about this? If we change the cell wall materials so that they break down more slowly, what happens is we slow this part of the cycle down. Just like if your paycheck's deposited in your checking account every week and you take less money out every week, what happens? Eventually, you get enough money to pay tuition at Iowa State, right? It accumulates. That's what we want to do. We want to slow the decay of these cell wall materials, which will increase the amount of carbon in the soil. So it's going to sequester CO2 out of the atmosphere. That's a good thing. It's going to increase soil organic matter, because that's what CO2 in the soil is. It's organic matter, and that's a good thing. It helps agriculture to have increased organic matter. And it can increase farm income, and I'm going to spend a few slides talking about this. And I think this is why this might work. Okay, so I need to give you a little primer about cap and trade and carbon credits. So it's clear that the global climate change is being driven by rising CO2 levels. One of the ideas to slow this or stop it or ideally turn it around completely is called cap and trade. So this is a program designed to reduce CO2 levels by placing a cost on carbon emissions. Right now, if I burn burn petroleum, releasing CO2 into the atmosphere, it affects all of you and it doesn't cost me anything. Let's charge me for burning petroleum and releasing CO2. That will make me be smart and clever and careful about burning petroleum products and releasing CO2. So the idea is to cap the emission. So I've released so much CO2, from now on I can release no more than that. I can't grow my CO2 emissions. Or maybe I'm even asked to reduce some. But, you know, my industry's growing. I'm doing something that really matters to the world. I'm making iPods, and they really are important. And I need to burn more CO2. So I can go find somebody who takes CO2 out of the atmosphere. Whoever can do it the cheapest, I pay them to take out the CO2 that I put in above my cap. This is cap and trade. It takes advantage of the free market to identify the lowest cost method of taking CO2 out of the atmosphere. So Europe already has a mandatory cap and trade system in place. And these carbon credits, the credits for people who take carbon out of the atmosphere, are traded. There's an exchange, the European Climate Exchange, where if you want to release CO2 into the atmosphere, you can go buy offsets that will, in fact, offset your production of CO2. In the U.S., we have a voluntary system, in the Chicago Climate Exchange, which is North America's answer to this European mandatory system. So it's voluntary, but you can, if you wish, if you think it would be good for your market, to say that whatever you're producing, in fact, is being offset by carbon sequestration, you can do so. You can buy those now in the U.S. At the market close Friday, each metric ton of CO2 was worth $5.50. Now, will this work in agriculture? Well, in fact, it's already working. There is already a market for agricultural sequestration of carbon. It already exists. So, if you have the right kind of agricultural practices, as I've shown you on one of the curves there, if you use no-till farming, you are actually sequestering carbon because soil organic matter is going up. And so there's a system in place led by the Iowa Farm Bureau Federation, which rewards farmers that use appropriate agricultural practices that sequester carbon. They can get paid. And the amount they get paid depends on how much carbon they sequester per acre. And that varies depending on where you are in the country because of the characteristics of cropping systems, the crops that are grown, the soil type. But in Iowa, they get a particular amount of money, which I'm going to show you on the next, $3.30 per acre per year. So what we want to do is add on to this existing carbon credit system. We want to modify plants to slow down the cycle. So we're not going to simply use altered agronomic practices. We're going to add altered genetic stocks, new varieties that slow down the decay of the material, the plant material, and therefore sequester carbon in the soil to give additional value to farmers. So how much is that worth? How much would farmers get for this? Is this even economically viable? So we've done a little modeling. What we decided to do was to say, starting now, let's give ourselves 20 years to get halfway between where we are now and where we were in 1900. We're not going to get all the way back. I don't think that's reasonable. Let's say we're going to get halfway there and we're going to do it in 20 years. So how much is that worth? Well, at current rates on the Chicago Exchange, farmers would get an additional $4 an acre. That would be an annual credit for Iowa corn growers of $56 million or $369 million for all corn growers in the United States. Now, this can be deployed over the entire planet, and it can be deployed not only with corn, but with turf grass, with soybeans, with any crop. So the potential here is quite a bit bigger. The other thing to look at, this is the price of carbon on the Chicago Exchange, and you see this was about $2, you can't see, but this was about $2 in January. All three major presidential candidates have come out in favor of mandatory cap and trade. What happened? The price started going up. There's a recognition that this is going to come. So we then projected what would happen, and I think this is reasonable, is if we get, or maybe when we get, mandatory cap and trade, let's say that the cost in the U.S. of carbon capture went to a rate similar to what's going on in Europe right now, what would happen? Well, then we're looking at $1.5 billion a year for carbon capturing crops, corn crops. We can also look again at turf grass and other crops. We can also deploy this around the world. And this does not include externalities. We know that if we increase soil organic matter, water quality improves. There's no money in here for that at all. That's just going to be one of those nice things that happens. Okay. So we have undertaken a project with great vehemence. We're really going at this hard. We've gone out and sampled 4,500 maize lines. And we've harvested the stalks and dug up the roots. And we're analyzing the chemical composition of these materials. We and others have genotyped these lines. So we can, and then we can also measure the rate at which these biomass materials decay in the soil. So we can do the sorts of association, the guilt by association studies that I was talking about earlier. We can identify the genes that are important for slowing down the decay of biomass, increasing soil organic matter, and taking CO2 out of the air. And incidentally, earning $1.5 billion for the Iowa farm economy. So where would this happen? We can envision a couple of different ways of deploying carbon capturing crops. Let's look at this case over here. So here we want to use the bulk of the stover for biofuels. But we don't want soil organic matter to be degraded. We want to find some balance. So we can, as molecular biologists now, and there are at least a dozen or two molecular biologists in the audience, and they could all tell you how this would work, but we can actually re-engineer one part of the plant to be ideal for biofuel production, and we can take the other part of the plant, including the roots, and convert it to be a carbon capturing crop. So we can use one part of the plant for biofuels and another part of the plant to capture carbon. And the reason for this means we could maintain soil organic matter and still take a lot of the crop, a lot of the stover away and use it for liquid biofuels and still keep our soil organic matter. Very important. We can also envision an alternative crop where the entire plant has been re-engineered for carbon capture. So this plant still produces grain, so we can still harvest the corn, sell that, but the rest of the plant body has been re-engineered to hold on to carbon in the soil. So where do these get planted? Well, one of the challenges with lignocellulosic crops is moving the stuff. There's a lot of bulk and a lot of mass, and it has to get moved from where it's grown in the farm field to some central facility. And these tend to be really big plants, which means they have to be centrally located, which means you have to ship the lignocellulosic material in trucks from the farm to the factory, or to the distillery. And if you get too far away, it just doesn't become cost-effective. Do you remember that old Seinfeld episode where they were taking returnable bottles in a postal truck, driving them across state lines? Nobody else watches Seinfeld. Okay. Anyway, if you go too far away, it's not cost effective. So what we can envision is that this kind of plant might be grown in the vicinity of the lignocellulosic ethanol plants. But as we get farther away, it's just not cost effective to bring that lignocellulosic material into the plant. So we would probably be growing plants that the entire plant body was using for carbon sequestration. Additionally, we might be growing these plants in the developing world, where it's possible to grow corn, but it's difficult to ship that corn because the road, the infrastructure just doesn't exist or it's terrible. But those folks in the developing world, $4 or $5 an acre or $10 an acre for carbon capturing from the developed world, so they would be thrilled to support our habit of burning petroleum. That would make a huge difference in the developing world. Okay, so to begin to wrap up, I want to give you just a quick taste of the future of genome-based crop improvement. Sequencing is driving this, and technology drives biology generally. Technology for sequencing is just undergoing a revolution. There's what's called next-generation sequencing. That's illustrated in this cartoon here. I'm not going to go through the details, but 10 times faster, 10 times cheaper, 10 times better. Computationally much, much harder, but that's why we have the Cernovus Alarus of the world. But it's going to get even faster and cheaper and better. There's an X Prize, you remember these things? $10 million for the first group that sequences 100 genomes in 10 days for $10,000 per genome. The Human Genome Project was probably $100 million. Now we're looking at $10,000 per genome. We're not there yet, but we will be soon. We will be able, in the agricultural community, to ride the coattails of these folks. The technology that's developed for sequencing human genomes for $10,000 a pop is going to allow us to sequence crop genomes for $10,000 a pop, and ultimately $1,000 a genome. This is going to change the way we do business. It's also very important, because we can get $30 million to sequence the corn genome. The wheat guys are working very hard to get money to sequence the wheat genome, and they're going to be successful ultimately. And the rice genome was already sequenced. The sorghum genome has been sequenced. But we eat a lot more than grain. Grain's critical, but you know, we eat all kinds of fruits and vegetables and all kinds of stuff. This is the Iowa State Fair. We eat a lot of stuff, and it's hard to justify $30 million to sequence that guy. This is actually a cactus, a fruit from a cactus from Taiwan. It's this guy here. Absolutely delicious. I mean, really, it's one of the best things I've ever eaten. But no way somebody's going to spend $30 million to sequence that genome. But as the cost of genome sequencing comes down to the $10,000 level, these genomes will get sequenced, and all the benefits of figuring out which genes are important for flavor and nutrient and perishability and so forth of this fruit will be determined. It will be possible to do that. So the future really looks very bright for genome-based crop improvement. I have been extraordinarily lucky with having lots of different collaborators over the years, and I'm just going to focus on a couple of current computational collaborators and just thank them for making my life a lot more fun, more interesting, and opening my eyes to different ways of looking at data and the world. Cernavis Alaru is a high-performance parallel computing scientist who's been just a fabulous colleague, and we've had a great time analyzing the maize genome together. Wei-Shin Cho is a computer scientist who has just built amazing software to help us analyze data that I just had no idea how we were going to analyze these data. And he came up with ways of making it made sense to us after he did it. Durbin Hayes is an ag economist who, as I said, has really fascinating ideas that explain why the world is functioning the way it is. I'm convinced economics explains an awful lot. And Dan Nettleton, who's here also, is a statistician, and we meet every week. He comes over to the CoLab and meets with me and my students for 1 or 2 hours every week, and it's one of the highlights of the week. He's just a super collaborator, helping us with the statistical and experimental design. The Plant Sciences Institute helps foster these sorts of kinds of collaborations, and we're very lucky on this campus to have a culture where people talk to each other outside of disciplines. This is really the way to make advances, and this campus, I didn't realize it till about 5 or 10 years ago, is different than many other campuses. People do collaborate in very, very effective ways across disciplines. I have a great team of students, graduate students, postdocs, and technicians that are really wonderful to work with. We also engage a lot of undergraduates in the lab. Some of them are here today. There are about 24 any one given semester that get to do research experiences in the lab. They get that. We get a lot of great enthusiasm from them and labor. And I just want to leave you with this picture of the carbon cycle and how we can improve it. I'd be happy to answer questions. They got their genome sequenced. All of them. Or a corn that eats fruit flies. You know, this is definitely also going to happen. You know, there is a finite supply of petroleum. It's not obvious to everybody, but most of what we have around us comes from petroleum ultimately. That's not going to last. We're going to need to find other sources of substrates to run our industries and our manufacturing processes. And that will probably be from plants or microbes. I didn't cover that because that's not something we're doing. It's been talked about a lot on this campus recently, but it's clearly going to happen. And knowing the genome and how that wiring diagram works together will allow us to make rational decisions about how pathways get integrated into the rest of the genome. So this is going to happen, I'm sure. But you've heard that before, so I didn't talk about that. You know, one thing that I always tell students is it's easy to ask. It's easier to ask questions now than later. It just gets harder because later on people think you ought to know. Right now this is new, so you can ask anything you want. Yes. This is, you know, when we, my wife Kathy and I had kids some years ago, long time ago. I mean, they were, the question then, I don't even hear people talking about it, but maybe I'm not talking to the right people, the people that are having kids, was cloth diapers versus disposable diapers, and what was better for the planet, and, you know, the immediate easy answer was not always the right answer. And this is why I think the sort of work that Dermot Hayes and the other economists are doing is really so critical, because the immediate obvious answer is not always the right answer. Local foods is one, okay? Immediately, we'd all like to buy our food at the farmer's market, buy local food. And certainly, I'm probably going to do that regardless of anything. But it's not always going to be the best thing for the planet for me to do that. It may actually use less petroleum to grow the stuff in California, ship tons and tons of it to the Midwest, efficiently distribute it to the grocery store, and we can pick it up when we go to the grocery store. Instead of me taking a separate drive in my car, burning gasoline, to go to the farmer's market, and some small farmer grower bringing lettuce or fruits from a farm. So I think that's where modeling and economics really helps us figure out what's true, what really is going to be the best. Now, there will be reasons we do otherwise. I am going to go to the farmer's market no matter what. I like it. Yes, Candy. That's a good question, and I think certainly I'm not going to be able to answer it now. I'm very much convinced that we let the plant tell us what's possible. So, you know, I can look at biochemical pathways and think about everything I know about genetics and try to come up with an answer. But I love this association mapping approach. It's like an essay question. You know, the difference between a yes-no quiz and an essay question. I can ask the plant, if I do this, is it better or not? And it gives me a yes or no answer. Association mapping is like an essay question. I can ask the plant to describe what will work best, what will give us highest yields. And that's what the association mapping would be doing. And I think that's the way to approach increases in yield.
What is the per plant barrier?
So what Candy Gardner is talking about here is that, you know, on a per plant basis, we're not seeing a lot more yield. The reason yields are going up, one big reason yields are going up, is we can put more plants per acre. It used to be, the old hybrids, if you put too many plants, well, let's look at us. If we were all crammed in a little room, we would all be fighting with each other and not very productive. As we spread out, we have more room. We can all have our own laptops out and be productive. So corn plants have been adapted so that they function better in crowding. They actually can produce grain under crowded conditions. And if they're producing the same amount or nearly the amount of grain per plant, having more plants gives you higher yield. So that's the issue there. Yes, Phil.
So the graph you showed crop yields, I mean, that's not all genetic yield,
right? No, it's not.
I wonder what it would look like if you planted petroleum inputs on top of that.
Yeah, so that's corn yields, and somewhere between one-third and two-thirds of that is due to genetic improvement, and the other one-third or two-thirds, depending on whether you talk to a geneticist or an agronomist, is due to improved agronomic practices. And you're also right that if we look at inputs, it's costing us more and more to get that higher yield in terms of inputs, too. Yes?
Do you have thoughts, let's say, written several of that
Yeah. This is a really good question. So you know what we can do this, but maybe we're going to get a mess. And this is why we have a center. This is why it's not just me and my students doing this. This is going to be a major enterprise, and it means we need to draw expertise from soil science and ag economics and biochemistry and statistics and computers. We need to bring all this together. But to, I think, allay your fears or your concerns a little bit, what our plan would be is to increase the concentration of compounds that already exist in the plant, those compounds that last a long time in the soil. So we're not going to make styrofoam and put that in the roots. We're going to take existing compounds and just increase the amount of the ones that stay around a long time. So my expectation is that this would give us a very similar kind of organic matter, but that's where we need to do a lot of tests. Other questions? Yes, Jack. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I will. Okay. This is a. You know, a lot of us in the room anyway are scientists, right? Okay. So, I was at the National Science Foundation, I was actually at a review panel at NSF, and my program manager. So this is the woman who basically organizes reviews and ultimately calls you up with good news or sends you an email of bad news about what money you're going to get. So. When she sends me an email, it goes into a special place in my inbox and noises, lights flash, and all that kind of stuff. So I listen to her, and I've never had any program manager ever recommend a novel, ever, ever, ever. She did. She said, you might find this interesting. I bought it and read it on the plane. It's called 40 Signs of Rain. It's by Kim Stanley Robinson. And this book really triggered this idea. The book is, it's fiction, but it's talking about scientists who are, some of them, at NSF, dealing with global climate change. And reading that book while thinking about re-engineering plants for biofuels is really what stimulated this idea. This book is also a great gift for those of you that are scientists and you have a spouse or a parent or relatives who kind of wonder what makes you tick. This book helps. I've given it to my wife, my mother, and my mother-in-law. They don't agree that I'm human yet, but they at least recognize that I'm not completely alien. You know, it gets inside the head of the scientist, and as he's driving, he's thinking about the evolutionary pressure on the idiots who don't use left turn signals and how over time our civilization will select away from those people. So it's a really good read. I mean, it's a good read. There's stuff in there that I don't agree with, so I'm not giving it. It's a good read. And it's interesting how you know, the non-science parts of our lives can stimulate us, actually. Yes?
Can you give a brief snapshot of the intersection between your work and food safety issues? Maybe how, you know, with developments in the maize genome,
yes.
How long might it take to get from the laboratory to the food table for a new crop or a new?
Sure. You know, this is not something that I'm doing at all. There is a food safety institute on campus that is looking at these things. I think it's clear that having the genome sequence will help us with food safety. One way I can see that is by making plants more resistant to insect feeding and fungal infection. We can reduce the accumulation of toxic compounds on foods like corn grain. So that's a good. We can also potentially increase the nutritive value of crops. We saw an example about vitamin A and how we can identify using this association or guilt by association mapping. We can identify genes that improve the nutritional content. Clearly, the genome sequence helps with those sorts of things, too. The big driver, unfortunately, is will someone pay for it? We're at the point now where we can do, if there's enough interest, we can do pretty much whatever is needed. But somebody needs to be willing to pay for it. And the somebodies are the federal government or foundations like the Gates Foundation or industry. And those are challenges. So there are a lot of good things that could be done in the world if there were sufficient funding. Unfortunately, there isn't always. Okay. Oh, one more?
Yeah. I think on the one slide you showed if there was a 20% increase in the carbon capture that, say, I think it's either Iowa or the U.S., that 380 million or something like that.
Yeah.
And based on what breeding companies have done in the past, what percent of that do you think would actually go to the breeding companies? I mean, that's what they've done to the other species.
No, you're absolutely right, and I'm very careful. Well, you know, I don't on this one. I usually am careful. I didn't do it here. This goes into the ag sector. I need to be careful about that. That is for sure won't all go to the grower. This is the way the market works. And I think appropriately that the seed companies are going to have to, I mean, we'll do the basic work here. Somebody's going to have to actually generate the hybrids, the seeds, and they will need to capture some of that income stream for themselves. There's a lot of argument about what's an appropriate amount. And I suspect you're on the grower side or are close to folks and recognize that issue. And I understand.
I work for a seed company.
Okay, but then you recognize the other side of it. I recognize that too. There will be a distribution.
Okay. Let's thank Pat for...